We're in this class going to be talking about what's referred to as the Table of Nations, which is found in Genesis, the 10th, and also part of the 11th chapter. There's really connectedness there that we need to see and understand some of the things we're going to be looking at and talking about. But I'm not starting right away with the 10th chapter of Genesis. I want to look at a few things by way of background first, in order to try and make a little bit more sense of some of the points that I want to make along the way regarding the content of those two chapters, Genesis 10 and the first half of chapter 11. The book of Genesis is the book of beginnings. I think that most of us know that. It starts with the story of the creation of the world, and it ends with the story of the death of Joseph in Egypt, with the people of Israel, the descendants of Jacob, being in Egypt, setting the stage for the story of the nation building the nation of Israel out of that situation. The overall authorship of Genesis is attributed to Moses. We have various scriptures that speak of Moses being the source of the law, and the law really encompasses the first five books of the Bible, from Genesis through Deuteronomy. If we look, for example, in what Jesus says in Luke, in Luke the 24th chapter, when he's talking to his disciples after his resurrection, and he makes reference in Luke chapter 24, verse 27, beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded to them all the scriptures, the things concerning himself. And likewise, a little further along in that same chapter, Luke 24, verse 44, he said to them, "These are the words which I spoke to you when I was still with you, that all these things must be fulfilled, which were written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me." And when he mentions those three categories, that's the entirety of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, the law, the prophets, and the Psalms, or the writings, the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms. And in the Gospel of John, John chapter 1 and verse 17, John also affirms that idea that Moses was the source of the law, not just the Ten Commandments and the associated things there, but rather the entirety of that those first five books of the Bible. John 1:17, "For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." And his readers in the first century, the Jewish readers, certainly would have understood the reference to the law there being to the first five books of the Bible, spoken of inclusively as the law. The law came through Moses. However, that doesn't mean, and it's one of the things that I want to point out and talk a little bit about today, that doesn't mean that it all originated with Moses. It doesn't mean that this information was new when Moses put it down. In fact, far from it. The story of creation certainly wasn't new when Moses put it down. The story of Abraham certainly wasn't new when Moses put it down. But he is credited with the overall authorship. We look at John chapter 7, or I invite you to consider John chapter 7 at any rate, verses 19 through 23. And Jesus was talking with some Jews there that were curious and a little bit hostile toward him. And he says, John chapter 7, verse 19, "Did not Moses give you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me?" The people answered and said, "You have a demon. Who's seeking to kill you?" Jesus answered and said to them, "I did one work, and you all marvel. Moses therefore gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers. And you circumcise a man on the Sabbath." And he goes on to talk about how that's an exception to the law of rest on the Sabbath. But that little caveat that Jesus issues there in verse 22, "Moses gave you circumcision," and then the parenthetic expression, "not that it was from Moses." It wasn't from Moses, but from the fathers, or from the patriarchs. The same word there, from the patriarchs. Circumcision came from the patriarchs, not from Moses. And I think that's true, not just in terms of perhaps oral tradition. I think that's true that there was a written account of God giving the covenant of circumcision to Abraham. And we're going to look at a few things that pertain to that. In the Exodus, the 40th chapter, we have the account of the finishing of the building of the tabernacle. Now, there are various craftsmen who are named as the men who had the skill, the talent given to them by the Spirit of God to make the various articles that went into the tabernacle and do all the work of the tabernacle. But at the end of the story, in the 40th chapter of Exodus, when everything pertaining to the tabernacle had been crafted and had been built according to specifications, In Exodus 40, verse 16, we read, "Thus Moses did according to all that the Lord had commanded him, so he did. And it came to pass in the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was raised up. So Moses raised up the tabernacle, fastened its sockets, set up its boards, put in its bars, and raised up its pillars." And it goes on to describe Moses spreading the tent, Moses setting the posts in place, and so forth. Now, how many of you have ever set up a tent? Or watched somebody set up a tent? Okay. How many people does it take to set up a tent? Depends on the tent. Okay. All right. What about this tent? It was a big one. Yeah, it was a big one. How big was it? All right, it was 30 cubits long, right? 45 feet long, and 10 cubits wide, 15 feet wide, 10 cubits high, 15 feet high. But Moses erected the tabernacle, right? Right? It says Moses erected the tabernacle. It says he stretched the cover over the tabernacle. What's that mean? He was in charge. It means he was in charge. Now, I use that in an illustrative way to say that when Moses wrote the law, that doesn't mean that God put everything into his head from beginning to end. It doesn't mean he didn't have sources and resources that already existed. In the days of Abraham, it's evident in the story of Abraham, because a couple times God refers to it, that there were already known commands of God that were in written form. Some of the words that God uses to describe the responsibilities of Abraham refer to written rules and laws. That it doesn't mean that when Moses puts the book of Genesis into the form, or most of the form that we have today, that it was all just sort of by revelation into Moses' head from God, any more than it means that Moses was a big enough man to stretch the covering over, you know, a 45-foot tent all by himself. He didn't do that by himself. But he was the man responsible for doing that. He was the man who had the authority, who had the obligation from God. He was the man who brought it together under the direct guidance, under the inspiration, under the governance of God. God showed him what he wanted, and Moses made it happen. But Bezalel and Aholiab were some of the craftsmen, a couple of the craftsmen that did the workmanship. And they had a number of other craftsmen under them who did the weaving and the engraving and so on and so forth for the tabernacle. And when it came time to set it up, who set it up? Well, when I read the book of Leviticus, I conclude that it was Levites who set it up, and they were under the direction of Moses and of Aaron and of Aaron's sons. But it was Levites who did the physical work of setting it up. But Moses is the one who is specifically credited with doing that, because Moses was the one who was in charge of doing that. Moses was the one who had the responsibility of making sure that it was done according to the pattern that God had shown him in the mountain. And in Acts chapter 7, verse 44, Stephen, when he was giving his defense of the Christian faith, he didn't do much about defending himself before the Sanhedrin, but when he was giving his defense of believing in Jesus, the one sent by God, he said in Acts 7:44, "Our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness, as God appointed, instructing Moses to make it according to the pattern that he had seen." Who was instructed to make it? Well, Moses was instructed to make it. And who ended up setting it up? Well, Moses set it up. But in between there are a lot of hands of people who actually made the materials and handled the materials and set that thing up and took that thing down and moved that thing around and so on and so forth. But the hand of Moses is the responsible hand. And I think that when we look at the book of Genesis, for that matter, when we look at Exodus and Leviticus as well, because Moses didn't do all that handwriting himself, he had Joshua and others that are mentioned from time to time, priests who participated in doing some of the actual labor of writing. But when we look at Genesis, we're looking at something that comes by the authority of Moses, because God put him in that position of authority. But it doesn't mean that Moses was the author in the sense of sitting down and writing all those words for the first time. And we'll look at a few reasons why seems pretty likely that that's the case. The law came through Moses, but Jesus says Moses did not give circumcision. It was the patriarchs who gave circumcision. So perhaps Moses wrote Genesis in the same sense that he put the posts and the bases in their place, in the same sense that he stretched out the tent, in the same sense that he raised up the tabernacle. Now, in the ending of the Gospel of John, we have a statement about who the source of the Gospel of John is. And who would that be? Well, he's not referred to by name. He's never mentioned by name in the Gospel of John. He's always mentioned obliquely. How's he referred to? The disciple whom Jesus loved. Yeah. The disciple whom Jesus loved. And at the end of the Gospel of John, we have Jesus talking to Peter. And Peter is a little uncomfortable with some of the things in the conversation, but it's a conversation he really needed to have. And then Peter turns and sees the disciple whom Jesus loved following along behind them. And he asks Jesus a question about this man. And because of the way Jesus answered the question, which basically was saying to Peter, it's none of your business, but he didn't use those words. He said, if I want him to remain alive until I come, what's that to you? And because of the way Jesus answered that question, we're told that there arose a sort of a myth about John, about the disciple whom Jesus loved, that he would not die before Jesus came again. And that's sort of put at arm's length here, that that wasn't really what Jesus meant. Jesus did not say to him that he would not die at the end of verse 23 here in John 21. But verse 24, John 21, 24, this is the disciple who testifies of these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. Where do we have, not the author's name, but nevertheless the authority of the author attested for us in the Gospel of John? It's not in the beginning. It's at the end, okay? It's at the end. Now, that kind of a testimony is, or that kind of a finishing mark, that kind of a finishing statement, we actually still have it today in some books. It's called a colophon, C-O-L-O-P-H-O-N, which is a direct transliteration from the Greek word colophon, which I won't bother to spell for you, but it's a word, colophon, it's a word that refers to the finishing touch of a manuscript. That's what it means, the finishing touch, the finale, the peak, the final highlight. And in ancient times, as well as in the Middle Ages, as well as sometimes in book printing even today, a tablet inscription would be appended by a scribe at the end of a text. And that inscription might contain the name of the scribe, might contain when and where the tablet was copied or written, might have the name of the source of the material, or the name of the person that the tablet belonged to, a colophon at the end of a tablet. It might name the owner, it might name the one who had commissioned the writing of the tablet, it might name the scribe who had written the tablet. It might describe literary contents, the things that were in the tablet, might have a title or a catchphrase or something along those lines. So go with me, if you will, to Genesis chapter 37. And we have in Genesis 37:2 what is kind of a catchphrase in the book of Genesis. Genesis 37 and 2. The New King James puts it this way: this is the history of Jacob. And what follows that statement? Story of Joseph. Okay. So this is the history of Jacob. The story of Joseph going into Egypt and all the things that Joseph... No, that's the end, not the beginning. Very unfortunately, because chapter divisions and verse divisions all come about long after the writing of these materials, these statements in the text of the English Bible with our chapter divisions and verse divisions almost always look like they're the beginning of a section. But they're pretty much generally the end of a section, which is always followed or usually followed by the beginning of another section. But nevertheless, the history of Jacob. Well, this is actually, as I say, a catchphrase, and it's not usually rendered with the word history. In the New King James Version, it's usually rendered with the word genealogy. This is the genealogy of Jacob, or the King James, the generations of, or the NIV, the account of. This is the account of, and that's the rendering that I like the best because it makes the most sense in context, and I like consistency. I like the same word to be rendered the same way in the same book as much as possible when that fits context and consistency. And 11 times this phrase occurs in the book of Genesis. This is one of the 11 times. This is the account of Jacob. Well, it's not talking about what comes next, because what comes next is the story of Joseph. It's talking about what came before. This, we're kind of wrapping up. This is the end of the Jacob story. And we're moving on now into the Joseph story and how Israel came to be in the land of Egypt. And that's the emphasis of the next several chapters of the book of Genesis. This is the account of Jacob. Well, what I think that really is telling us is that the primary source of an ancient tablet that was available to Moses. You know, one of the things Stephen says about Moses is Moses was trained in all of the wisdom. Actually, that's Hebrews. No, it is Stephen. It's one or the other. That Moses was trained in all of the wisdom of the Egyptians, that he had had training in reading, and we would understand that he would have had training in the skills of reading and writing and a number of other things. And I also would suppose that his family, being aware of their destiny, would have retained things from the past. But at any rate, Jacob is presented to us here. This is the account of Jacob in the form of a colophon. That is an ending statement in Genesis 37 and 2. And if we back up in the book of Genesis, the first time we have one of those, that same catchphrase, even though it may not be rendered exactly the same in your Bible, it really is the same catchphrase, is in the second chapter of Genesis, in verse 4. Genesis chapter 2, verse 4. This is the history of the heavens and earth when they were created, or these are the generations of the heaven and earth when they, or this is the account of the heavens and earth when they were created. That's not a statement that begins what follows the story of the Garden of Eden. That's a statement that finishes what came before. That is the account of the creation, and who was there to see what happened on day one, day two, day three, day four? Well, no man was there to see that, and no man is attributed with that story. No human being is attributed with that. This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created. Only one being could give that account, the one who was there, who was doing the work. That had to come by revelation from God. However, the story that follows from Genesis 2:4, the second half, and on through the first verse of the fifth chapter, there was a man who could give that account. His name was Adam, which is why the same catchphrase, the same Hebrew catchphrase in Genesis 5:1, this is the genealogy of Adam, or this is the history of Adam, or these are the generations of Adam, or this is the account of Adam. Adam was in a position to give the account of what had happened in chapters 2, 3, and 4, of the book of Genesis. And we go forward and we have other instances, other examples, 11 times altogether in the book of Genesis, including Genesis chapter 10, verse 1, which is in our table of nations in our area of study this week. This is the genealogy, this is the history in those other verses, or this is the account of, or these are the generations of, this is the history of, this is the account of the sons of Noah, Shem, the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And then the next sentence is, and sons were born to them after the flood. But that is the conclusion of the story of the flood, which ends with the death of Noah. Okay, that's the last thing, I guess in a very real sense, that's probably the last thing that the sons of Noah had in common, was the death of their father, which was 350 years after the flood, according to the account. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. And this is the history of the sons of Noah, the account of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And that's looking backward at the account of the flood that we have recorded there. They lived through the flood. They went through the ark experience. And I think it's, to me, you know, the idea that we have ancient documents that were brought together by the hand of Moses under the inspiration of God, that go back to the actual individuals, the people who experienced these things, is completely consistent with the way other scriptures came into being. There are pointers all through the text to indicate that this is what was happening, what was going on when Moses brought these things together. And to me, that's really a tremendous thing to realize that we have essentially firsthand accounts by the people who experienced these things rather than some sort of a compilation later on that came through oral tradition or whatever other kind of means there may have been. But we have these, again, these colophons scattered all through. And not only do we have the one here in Genesis 10:1, but there is another one in Genesis 11 and 10. And the one in Genesis 11 and 10 says, this is the genealogy of Shem, this is the history of Shem, this is the account of Shem. And again, if that's the end rather than the beginning, it's saying to us that basically the table of nations, and I've taken 20 minutes to get to this point, But basically, the Table of Nations come to us through the hand of Shem, the son of Noah. Now, did he live long enough to do this? Yes, he lived long enough to do this. He lived long enough to see the generations that are described here. These things could have all very well come from the hand of Shem and been passed on to his family, down through the family of Abraham, ultimately into the hands of Moses to become a part of the law that Moses wrote at the direction of God, according to the pattern that God showed him. But if we look at the Table of Nations that way, and I like looking at the Table of Nations that way, it makes sense to me and it has appeal to me on various levels. How many of you have ever done genealogical research? And I bet if you're very young, you haven't. But how many of you, and what kind of resources do you use for genealogical research? Archives, what? Court documents?
Census.
Cemeteries. There's another one, though.
Military records,
yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. Talking to patriarchs and matriarchs who've been around a long time. And family Bibles, thank you. And family Bibles. Okay, why family Bibles? Yeah, I don't know how many people do that anymore. My parents have a family Bible that used to sit on the coffee table in the living room that was a gift from one of my aunts. And they, you know, went through and wrote down their parents and their children. And for a while, they wrote down their grandchildren, but eventually, you know, that got to be unwieldy. I think when it got to be about 59 grandchildren Anyway, eventually, they didn't do that anymore. But one of the great resources, when you go back past census records, because census records haven't always had a lot of information. Before about 1860, you don't get a lot of information out of the census. It's not always that helpful, somewhat helpful. But anyway, family Bibles have been a tremendous resource going back for hundreds of years for those people who've been interested in genealogical research. And it seems to me that this is that kind of a record, the kind of record that you'd have in the, you know, the front pages of a family Bible. This is like having a shot here at the front pages, the genealogical record of Shem's family Bible, which would have been a treasured possession. People treasure family Bibles. People treasure having that artifact from the past that, you know, has the names of their forebears and the personal touch and all that. But I would suggest to you that it's consistent with the way the book of Genesis is constructed, that while Moses is the author who brings together all of these sources, there are ancient sources coming from Shem, coming from Adam, coming from certainly God himself, coming from Noah, coming from the sons of Noah, coming from Terah, the father of Abraham, coming from Jacob, from Esau, from Ishmael, that there are sources that are all brought together by Moses, and different styles of authorship are apparent and so forth, but they are always marked with this sort of accrediting the ancient source that's being referred to. And here, the ancient source that's being referred to is accredited to Shem, the son of Noah, the second son of Noah, Japheth being the eldest, and Ham being the youngest, and Shem being the apparently the middle child. So we have a sort of a family record, if you will, and that's also evident in several aspects of the contents that we have in the Table of Nations. If you look at the Table of Nations, and we're going to talk about these things later, but not today. We're going to talk about the names of the various people and the nations that come from them, which is why it's called the Table of Nations. But if you look in the 10th chapter of Genesis, verses 2, 3, 4, we're looking at the sons of Japheth here, and that's given to us in verses 2 through 5. The sons of Japheth are given to us in verses 2 through 5. Then we have the sons of Ham, and the sons of Ham are given to us in verses 6 through 21, a much larger section, a lot more names of the sons of Ham than of the sons of Japheth. And then if we look at the sons of Shem, the children of Shem in verses 21 and following, well, it really starts the listing in verse 22. Verses 22 down through 32, we have the sons of Shem. And again, it's a relatively large section. And the family of Shem is going to be revisited in the 12th chapter in the account of Terah, the father of Abraham. But there's a big emphasis on the children of Ham. There's a big emphasis on the children of Shem, and there's not much emphasis on the children of Japheth. Now, if I take a poll around the room to find out who most of us are descended from, which of those sons of Noah are we going to find that most of us are descended from? Japheth. How come he ignored our family line, huh? How come we don't get a big section here when there's so many of us that have come through the lineage of Japheth? Well, because this wasn't about, you know, our day and time. This was about the circumstances of the people of Israel. It was about the world in which they lived. And Japheth is certainly acknowledged, but Japheth kind of moves out of the picture. The lineage of Japheth, the descendants of Japheth, kind of move out of the picture there in what we call the Middle East and the Near East. They become what's referred to by and large as the Indo-European people, the people who went north and the people who went west. They don't have a lot to do with the story of the Bible in those chapters up through Malachi. They don't have a lot of relevance in the things that happen there. The children of Ham, on the other hand, well, there's constant things, constant interaction, and much of it violent, but constant interaction with the families of the children of Ham on the part of those people who are the descendants of Shem. And so that's where the emphasis is, and that's where you would expect the emphasis to be if this is a product of, again, a family record. It would be a family record that focuses on the real people that you actually deal with and doesn't focus so much on those people who are at a greater distance and not so much involved. So we have, based on Genesis 9 and verse 28 and Genesis 10 and verse 1, the idea that all three of Noah's sons outlived him. They saw the death of their father. They lived long enough to do that. In fact, Noah lived 350 years after the flood. We don't know how long Ham and Japheth lived, but we do know that Shem lived 500 years after the flood. And by the way, this is just a place for me to throw in. I meant to throw it in somewhere. That I believe the book of Genesis. I hope you believe the book of Genesis. I believe Genesis chapter 1, that in 6 days God created the heavens and the earth. I believe that the descendants of Adam lived as long as 969 years. And I believe that there was a literal flood that destroyed the earth as described in Genesis chapter 6 and 7. And those things I accept as reality, as historical truth. And I think there is abundant evidence that gives it plausibility, credibility, that we can put our confidence in these accounts because, number one, they are the testimony of God, and number two, they don't contradict any actual truth, any verifiable evidence that we can consult and confirm today. They are consistent with what we genuinely know. They're not consistent with what a lot of people believe. They're not consistent with a lot of interpretive ideas and presuppositions, but it is consistent with those things that we know to be true. And I accept these things as true. That Noah lived 350 years after the flood, that Noah's sons, at least Shem, lived 500 years after the flood, which is to say another 150 years after his father. And the indication of the idea of these catchphrases being colophons, being end statements, would give us that Noah's sons were together for his funeral. You know, Noah lived 350 years after the flood and he died. This is the account of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, that his sons were together in that one final thing, which is after the event that we refer to as the Tower of Babel, after the confusion of the languages. And I really imagine that confusion of languages affected those men, what does that do to your family relationships when you can't talk to each other anymore, you know, and have to learn a new language in order to talk to your relatives? So we'll talk about that later on down the line when we get into the names and the events that are mentioned to us in the 10th chapter here of Genesis. But think about the things that those men had experienced. They had experienced something that nobody else in all the world had experienced, Shem, Ham, and Japheth and their wives. They had experienced something that no one else in all the world had experienced. And I don't just mean the flood, which was a pretty traumatic thing to go through, but they had experienced the world before the flood. They had experienced a world that none of their descendants had seen or known except by whatever stories they would tell. And would they tell stories? Would they? Of course they would tell stories. You know, when you're getting to be about 450 years old and you want to entertain the great-great-grandkids, you're going to, or, you know, you, of course they would tell stories of how it was in the days before the flood. And that probably has some bearing on the way some things shaped up in their descendants as well, especially if they told those stories with any sort of fondness for the way that it used to be and any sort of nostalgia for what great things we were able to do back in the day, back when. But these men lived through things that none of their descendants had ever seen or ever would see, including a world that was destroyed. and including the episode of the flood itself, the building of the ark, living through the flood, and all of that. And just to lend itself to the idea that we understand that the flood we're talking about here, that was before the Table of Nations here, in the seventh chapter of Genesis, in verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Now, I don't read that as, a rainstorm came up and it rained for a long time. I read that as utterly catastrophic, that the fountains of the deep were broken up and the windows of heaven were opened. And this is not the kind of storm that you have ever experienced in your life or you would ever want. And this is a storm that's happening all over the world all at the same time. And it's a storm that involves the geology and involves the fountains of the deep bursting forth, volcanic type activity, as well as downpours, deluge from above. And when it says the windows of heaven, I don't think we're quite sure exactly what that means, what the waters above the firmament really amounted to, except that it was enough to rain and rain and rain and rain for 40 days all over the world. Until, as it says in the account here in Genesis, until every living thing on the face of the earth, everything that breathes air, died. Verse 19, Genesis 7:19, the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, all that was on the dry land died. So God destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, man, cattle, creeping thing, bird of the air, they were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. Now, how long did that go on? Well, you've got 40 days, and then you've got 150 days, and then you have coming to rest. You've got a 40-day period. You've got a 7-day period. But how long it all went on is given to us finally in, it's in the 8th chapter. I didn't write down the reference, and I... which is it, 13th? The 601st year, the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried up, but that's not quite it. 14, in the second month, the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried, and God said, go out of the ark, which is a year and 10 days, all right? They'd been a year and 10 days in the ark from the time God told them to go in, and the rain started, and the breaking up of the ground started. A year and 10 days they'd been in the ark, and when they came out of the ark, what did they find? Well, it had to be pretty bleak, because what was there that had been there before? Nothing. Nothing was there that had been there before. The trees were all new trees. They were all saplings just starting to grow. The animals were the animals that were with them in the ark. That's it. That's the population of air-breathing animals is what comes off of the ark with them at that point. This is a devastated, desolate world. Now, there have been movies made about apocalyptic events, you know, and you'll see a movie, maybe the Statue of Liberty is up to its neck in mud and things like that. No, that's not enough. That's not nearly enough for what happened during this event, during the flood event here. That's not nearly enough to describe what happened here. There were no artifacts from the previous civilization left. There was nothing left of what had been there before. There was no matching geography. There was nothing that matched what had been there before. They came out into a whole new world. And Peter refers to that in the third chapter of 2 Peter when he refers to the world that then was, that perished, that was destroyed in Noah's deluge. 2 Peter, the third chapter, in verses 5 and 6, this they willingly forget, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, by which the world that then perished, perished, being flooded with water. The world that Noah and his family had known was gone. It wasn't there anymore. They came out into a new world, and it was a new world full of potential, but it also was a very bleak and barren world when they came out into it, with only very young plant life and the population of animals being seeded from what came out of the ark. And I think this flood is also referred to in 104th Psalm, when at the end of the flood, it refers to the limits that God set for the waters. Psalm 104, verses 5 through 9, "You who laid the foundations of the earth so that it should not be moved forever, you covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the voice of your thunder they hastened away. They went up over the mountains. They went down into the valleys to the place where you, which you founded for them. You have set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth." Well, those poetic words seem to be describing very catastrophic things that are happening at the end of the flood, with valleys going down and mountains coming up and waters receding. And it was a tremendous series of events, utterly devastating and changing to the world that had existed prior to the flood. And I bring that up in part because I want us to appreciate a little bit of what's going on with names that we see in the book of Genesis. In Genesis, the second chapter, we have the only tidbit of pre-flood geography, you know, the only little idea of what the geography of the pre-flood world was like. And it only deals with a little tiny section of the world. We may have the notion, and I actually do have the notion, that there was only one continent prior to the flood. That sort of seems to be suggested with the description of dry ground and waters that we have in the first chapter. But whether that's the case or not, this is the only real description of geography that we have. Genesis chapter 2, verses 10 through 14. "A river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it parted and became four river heads. The name of the first is Pishon. It's the one which skirts the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold, and the gold of that land is good. Bdellium and the onyx stone are there. The name of the second river is Gihon. It's the one that goes around the whole land of Cush. The name of the third river is Hiddekel, or the Tigris. It's the one which goes toward the east of Asher." The New King James has the word Assyria here, but Asher is the word. "The fourth river is the Euphrates." And then it goes on and talks about the creation of man. Well, we have two rivers named there that we know today, right? The Euphrates and the Tigris River. And so a lot of people assume that the writer of Genesis is telling us that the Garden of Eden is in the Fertile Crescent over there in the Middle East. No, that's not at all what we're being told here. Especially if you'll remember, and if you'll just go along with me if it seems unusual or strange to you, this is Adam's account. That's what it says in 5:1. This is Adam's account. Adam's telling us what he experienced, what he saw. This isn't Shem's account. This isn't the account of the post-generation, the post-flood generation. This is the account of the pre-flood generation, the one man who experienced the Garden of Eden firsthand. This is Adam's account. Now, do the Tigris and the Euphrates River in the modern world have a common headwaters? Because these four rivers, it says, have a common headwaters. There's a river, and it divides into the headwaters of these four rivers. Do the Tigris and Euphrates in the modern world, the post-flood world, have a common headwaters? The answer is no. The headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates are 50 miles apart. They both come out of Turkey, but they're 50 miles apart. Are we talking about the same rivers? Well, again, the answer is no. There's a place called Cush here. There's a place called Cush later in the Bible. What's the place called Cush later in the Bible? What's that in reference to? What nation or land? Ethiopia in Africa, okay? That's where the descendants of Cush, the son of Ham, settled, is in Ethiopia in Africa. Some of them, anyway, went there. And that's nowhere near where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers flow. We're not talking about the same Cush. And what we need to understand, and again, this goes to the idea of how, you know, genealogies and family memories and things like that work. What we need to understand is that if we travel around in Missouri, we might find a place called Amsterdam. Anybody here ever been to Amsterdam in Missouri? Or
Damascus,
okay. Damascus, Missouri, or Paris. There are seven Parises in the United States. Where did that name come from? They're all named after the French city, right? Because people came over here and they thought it was a pretty name, or they had reminiscences or whatever else. And so they named the city here after the city there. We have rivers in the U.S. that are named after rivers in Europe because, again, the same thing. We have robins in America, even though there are no American robins. Why? Well, because people saw those red-breasted birds and said, hey, that's a lot like the robins that we used to have back in England. And so they called them robins, even though they're not the same bird. We have Madrid in Missouri. We have Glasgow, Missouri. We have Amsterdam, Missouri. We have Paris, Missouri. We have Vienna. Is it called Vienna here, or is it Vienna or something else? I don't know. But anyway, we have Vienna. All those town names are names that are recapitulating names from somebody's past. Okay. Well, the same thing happens with the post-flood generation. We have names that are recapitulated. That doesn't mean they're the same place. In fact, we can have every confidence that the Tigris and Euphrates rivers that are described in Genesis chapter 2 are not the Tigris. The description doesn't match at all, for one thing. But for another thing, there is the fact that the Bible does speak of what happened to the Garden of Eden. Now, in the book of Ezekiel, the 31st chapter, it's poetic and it's prophetic, and it's talking about the king of Assyria and what God had done to Assyria and the fact that it would never rise again as a great power. But Ezekiel spoke of the Garden of Eden and the trees of the Garden of Eden. Ezekiel chapter 31, verse 3, indeed Assyria was a cedar in Lebanon. Ezekiel uses a lot of that kind of poetic imagery, referring to great rulers as living things, such as trees, such as crocodiles or dragons, things like that. Indeed, Assyria was a cedar in Lebanon with branches that shaded the forest and so forth. And so he's talking about Assyria in the verses that follow and using it as an illustration of how God brings down the mighty. Verse 9, God says, I made it beautiful with a multitude of branches so that all the trees of Eden envied it that were in the garden of God. Okay, he brings up the idea of Eden there. But he goes on, in verse 11, therefore I will deliver it, that is Assyria, into the hand of the mighty one of the nations, and he will surely deal with it. I have driven it out for its wickedness. God's done with Assyria because of the wickedness of Assyria. In verse 16, in Ezekiel 31, verse 16, I made the nation shake at the sound of its fall, the fall of Assyria, when I cast it down to the pit, to Sheol. The New King James has the word hell here, and I don't like that word because it conveys all kinds of wrong impressions to people. People don't know what hell is. There's confusion about that because different words in the Bible are rendered in different English versions with that word. Down to Sheol, down to the pit, down to the depths. I made the nation shake at the sound of its fall when I cast it down to the pit, down to Sheol, together with those who descend into the pit, and all the trees of Eden, the choice and best of Lebanon, all that drink water, were comforted in the depths of the earth. Where does he say Eden, the trees of Eden, where are they? In the depths of the earth, okay? In the depths of the earth. In fact, my suspicion, it's in the Marianas Trench in the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, but that's just my suspicion. At any rate, Eden is buried in the depths of the earth. When did that happen? Well, it happened during a year and 10 days when floodwaters prevailed on the earth and the fountains of the deep were opened and things were going up and things were going down and the whole face of the earth was being reshaped. The trees of Eden are in the depths of the earth. He goes on and says a little bit more about that. Verse 17, they went down to the pit with it, with those slain by the sword and those who were strong-armed dwelt in the shadows among the nations. To which of the trees of Eden will you be likened in glory and greatness? Yet you shall be brought down with the trees of Eden to the depths of the earth. So anytime anybody says to you, you know, well, where's the Garden of Eden? Well, the flood kind of put an end to that. It hasn't been here since then. In fact, the only reference to the tree of life after the flood is where? Where's the tree of life? Book of Revelation, it's there at the river of life that flows from the throne of God. That's the tree of life that exists now. Is the tree of life that is there by the throne of God in heaven. The Garden of Eden is no more, and the surrounding geography is no more. It went down to the depths of the earth. It was buried under sedimentary deposits, under the flood deposits, and it is no more. Now, we have several different names in the second chapter of Genesis that turn up elsewhere in Genesis, but that's the same way that you have the name Charles. Are there any other Charleses present here today? There's one. All right. Yeah, we're not the same guy, you know, even though we happen to have the same first name. But you'll find coincidence of names. You'll find sometimes even coincidence of more than one name. You can find different families that have sons named Sheba and Dedan in the accounts in Genesis 10 and in Genesis 25. Abraham had a son named Jokshan who had sons named Sheba and Dedan. Well, we also have somebody with sons named Sheba and Dedan in the 10th chapter of Genesis. Are they the same Sheba and Dedan? Well, if you ever do genealogical research, you'll find these kinds of coincidences a lot more often than you would expect. These kinds of things actually happen frequently, where family names will have a lot of matches, and you'll think, well, am I looking at the same family here? And you'll find out they're far, far apart and not the same people at all. And certainly that's the case here. And I'm 5 minutes into what was designated as question time, but in my defense, I didn't know we had question time. So with what I have said so far, don't ask me about anything I haven't talked about yet, because we'll do it later. But with what I've said so far, by way of, you know, just introductory ideas, does anybody have a question? Proverbs 8:29. When he assigned to the sea its limit, so the waters could not transgress it. Yeah, that's referring again to God redoing the geography when he put the waters in into the present seas as we know them. The same thing that's referred to in Psalm 104. Yeah. Janet?
Are there references in Adam's account? What I'm getting at is, could the Garden of Eden and Adam's family life in the area taken place on what we know today as a different continent? And then do we have any reference to know that it's even in the area everybody thinks it started?
No, actually very much to the contrary. I doubt it was anywhere near the area where the modern civilization originated, where the post-flood civilization originated. I doubt it was anywhere near that area. There's no reason to think it would have been. They drifted around on the waters, you know, from wherever they started and ended up there, and there would be no reason at all to suppose that God would have put them anywhere close to the starting place of humankind before the flood. I actually think, and this is really a side but sort of related, I actually think that what's referred to as continental drift, that a big part of that happened during the flood, that the original continent was broken up during that geographical upheaval and the assault that took place on planet Earth during those days, that they came out into a world with multiple continents where they had gone into the ark in a world with probably one large continent. That's what I think. Marvin? When it comes to, for example, the floodwaters covering the earth, it's the whole world. Everything that had breath in it, all the mountains under heaven were covered. It's very explicit about that. I doubt that the mountains before the flood were as tall as the mountains after the flood because of this continental movement thing that was taking place there. I think that they came into a brave new world, a world that was much different than the one they had left behind, not only because of the desolation, but because of the changes in geography. I know there were hands over here, too. Go ahead. Yes. Yes, I would say that. We have a place in the 6th chapter where it says this is the account of Noah, referring backward to the things that were between Adam's account and his entering into the ark. And then that next section is attributed to his sons, the three sons of Noah. So yes, I would say that the account of the creation, both the divine account and the account by Adam, were family heirlooms that were taken aboard the ark, yes. Janice?
Since he asked that, I'll bring up the point. It could have been oral transmitted also.
It could have been, but I'm very doubtful of that. I, for a variety of reasons, including the fact that a colophon is very much a literary tradition. It's very likely. You know, there used to be an argument, and in fact it's still out there. In the 1960s was the first time I ever ran into it. I had a cousin who was going to university in Fresno, and one of his professors had told him, you know, Moses couldn't have written the law because they didn't know how to write back then. Well, that was stupid when he said it, but it was still influential to this cousin who thought his professor knew a lot of stuff. There was lots of writing older than Abraham that was already known at the time when that statement was made. But writing is as old as humanity as far as anything that we actually know. I mean, there are certainly lots of people who think otherwise. But as far as anything we know of human civilization, writing is as old as human civilization. Let's bear in mind that God didn't create dummies. He didn't create Neanderthals in the sense that that term has been used. He created intelligent people, and he created intelligent people who had a long life in which to create ideas and bring them into reality. From the very beginning, we have people doing things that we might consider incredible with our little short lifespans and the kind of interaction that we require to get much of anything done. There were other hands. Go ahead.
With the idea, going back to 2 Peter and the idea of the earth perishing, what you're suggesting makes perfect sense, because he then links that with the coming of a new earth.
With the utter destruction of everything. Right. Tom? Was it set up for... designed around the idea of Noah's family starting over?
Today, yeah.
That's not exactly what you're trying to ask, but yeah, God had in mind there, and I think we see this recapitulated in the Babel incident that comes very shortly after that. God was looking at a situation where humankind was totally out of hand, and the only options that were available were total destruction or near total destruction. Humanity was on the verge of self-annihilation, at least spiritually and probably physically too, it sounds like to me. Every thought of man's heart was only evil continually, and the earth was filled with violence for man's sake. Man was on the verge of total self-annihilation, and God rescued a group of people out of that and purposefully left all of the technology. You know, people wonder about the technology of building a wooden boat, and man, I don't have any idea what kind of technology they had developed by Noah's day, but I don't think that it was anywhere near as crude as some people might imagine with the minds and the lifespans that we're talking about there. But whatever, God purposefully obliterated the culture and the technology that had preceded Noah to give his family a fresh start. I don't know if they totally appreciated that, you know. I mean, if you went from the conveniences that you enjoy to living in tents in the... You got any wilderness around here? I don't know, in the Mark Twain parks, you know. If you suddenly were... In fact, you'd have big advantages over what they had, because they had to still live on stuff out of the ark for a while until the fruit trees started getting big enough to bear fruit and so on and so forth. But they were, you know, they were living on preserved rations and things like that. But God wanted a total break with the past, and he brought that total break about, except for the memories of the people who came off the ark. That was the only residue of that culture that really remained. Go ahead.
The flood waters were fresh water or salt water?
Well, I'm sure they were fresh water. But salt water is a result of runoff from the continents and the rivers, you know. I think that what we have today is an adaptation since then of the marine life that dwells in salt water. God made creatures very adaptable, and as the accumulations of salts and minerals in the seas has occurred, the wildlife has adapted accordingly over the generations. But I believe that, yes, the water that came forth was certainly fresh water. Whether the seas had already been salt water before that, they had been having runoff before the flood, you know. Whether the seas had already been salt water, the water from above and the water from below would have been primarily fresh water, and at least for a time, the seas would have been much less salty than they are today. Right, pretty much. Those things that could breathe water were still around, but those things that breathed air were gone. Yeah, Christy?
Uh-huh. What kind of division is that?
Now, you're doing what I said not to do.
We're talking about continents.
I don't think that's what it was. There was a time when I read something that made me think, well, that makes a certain amount of sense, but I don't think that anymore. But when we get to Peleg, what happened with Peleg's generation was big. It wasn't little. It was big. I don't think it was geographic particularly. But it was physiological. because what happens at Peleg's generation, and this is for actually Thursday, but what happens with Peleg's generation is we see a sudden change in the genealogical record of people living 400 years to people living 200 years. And it's an overnight change. It's not a gradual transition. Just like the flood brought a sudden change in human lifespan, you know, the Noah's generation had lived 900 plus years. His son's generation lived only 600 years. And their great-great-grandson's generation lived 200 years. But in between, there's the 400. But each of those changes are very abrupt, indicating that something really big happened. And we may not know exactly what the big thing is, but something really big happened. But that's a prelude for later on in the week. But no, I do not think that there was a catastrophic movement of land masses in Peleg's time. I don't think that's the case. Although I might have thought that at some point in time when I was reading and studying these things, but I don't think that now. Go ahead. Well, one of the things as we go into tomorrow the account of these individuals that are named in the 10th chapter of Genesis is that we should never think that our forebears were ignorant or dumb or any of those kinds of notions, because that's not the case. God created intelligent human beings. He created human beings that were full of potential, and that potential, because of sin, has been wasted, just so much waste of what humankind is capable of doing. And that has caused God to intervene from time to time in human history to bring a stop to the waste. And we'll have, you know, definite incident of that here in the names in the Table of Nations. But don't underestimate your forebears, because the things that they accomplished are far beyond, well, what I ever expect to accomplish in my life and achievements. We're talking about people who were created with tremendous potential. And when we're going back this far, we're talking about people who had a much longer life than I have in store for me to explore that potential and to do the things that they were going to do. We'll pick it up in the 10th chapter of Genesis tomorrow and talk a little bit more about the specifics of the Table of Nations. So thank you for going with me through a little prelude.